This is Pixelated Playgrounds, a gaming book club podcast discussing the art and craft of video games. I'm Brian Skirsha.
I'm Josh Galecki. And today we're talking about Tunic. Developed by Isometric Games and published by Finji, this game was released for PC, Switch, Xbox Series X, and PS5 in 2022. We'll be talking about spoilers here, so heads up if you're sensitive to that.
Yeah, and spoilers there are in this game. I think everything we're going to say from probably about here on out is a spoiler. So
it's very true. This game was very heavy on the sense of discovery and really trying to make that a part of the game. So even talking about things, talking about mechanics is going to be spoiling some stuff for you guys. So if you are thinking about playing this and don't want those spoilers, then go ahead. This podcast will be here when you get back.
Yeah, it's worth mentioning, at least from my perspective, that this is a game that has like multiple levels that you can engage with it on. Like, you don't have to 100% it to appreciate why it's a great game. So if you're even remotely curious about Tunic and what makes it great, get in there, check it out. I think you'll probably find something to like if you're in a certain gamer cohort, being, say, a millennial myself. There's a lot of millennial-friendly vibes for gaming in this game.
Are you talking about the game's look and its soft edges, and now that we're getting old, we don't like sharp things as much?
Yeah, exactly. It's a pastel, very soft and fluffy, and it's got a cute fox, and oh wait, never mind, it's balls hard.
Yes, this game will murder you and not think twice about it.
But it does have an accessibility mode, so hey.
Oh.
Concessions for everyone. At any rate, this is a wonderful game that I played right when it came out back in the 2022 timeframe, fresh off of my binge of Elden Ring, which is, I guess this was my Elden Ring detox game, which is an interesting way to think about this one.
You're like, oh, I'm only getting murdered half as much as I was in that other game.
Yeah, and I'm only, well, I was probably equally as much confused, because this is a game that definitely prides itself on confusing the shit out of you. But yeah, I mean, what made you play this recently here, Josh? You know, I was a little surprised to see that you were revisiting this one, especially when I brought it up as a possible cast game a year ago, almost to the day.
Well, this was a game that I played maybe an hour of last year, or maybe in 2022. Don't remember exactly what. I played about an hour of it, and I liked what I saw so far. I got to get the first game manual page, first page of the instruction booklet, and I really thought it was a cool mechanic. But getting through that first, I guess through the forest, East Forest, it kind of lost me along the way there. Like, I saw the gorgeous visuals and everything. I saw the intriguing mechanic. But I think this was when I was playing Elden Ring 2, and maybe it was a difficulty of the game, or maybe it was just like, I need a break from the action stuff right now. So I'm going to say I needed a different type of Elden Ring detox at the time.
But fair enough.
I've got the newborn that I'm spending a lot of time holding on the couch, and let me tell you, Steam Deck, Nintendo Switch, those are great family bonding experiences for me and my two-month-old. Picked up Tunic and really tore through it, and really loved this game. This was one of my top 10 games last year.
Awesome. Yeah, that's excellent. So here's a quick question. Did you play on Switch then?
This was a Steam Deck game for me.
Okay, yeah, so I played it on Game Pass because it came out on Game Pass in mid-2022, and that's when I picked it up and played it. Boy, that was like the heady days of like really excellent string of Game Pass releases right there. But I remember playing this right around the same time I played Death's Door, actually, and trying to compare the two, and they are similar on a surface level, but completely different below the surface, I would say.
Well, I think both of them, you know, they have that isometric view. I think this was when we were doing the Death's Door cast, too, or playing for that. So maybe I felt it was like, it felt like, okay, this is kind of the same thing over here. Like, I get my action fix or something. But they both have difficult combat. They both kind of take a little bit of the Souls-like combat, like the dodge roll being so important and everything. But yeah, the games definitely, and the way they organized combat and exploration were very different.
Yeah, we'll talk about this later, but I think the combat is head and shoulders better in Death's Door, but this game has a lot of other things going for it that bring it up to a similar level of excellence, in my opinion. At any rate, let's set a bit of the stakes here. This game was developed starting in 2015, given that it came out in 2022, that is 7 years in development.
That is a hell of a development cycle right there, yeah.
Yeah, and for a game that is basically, you know, branded, or at least on the surface perceived as a combination of Zelda, Fez, and I guess a splash of Dark Souls, you know, you could understand where someone who's trying to live up to those types of expectation could spend a lot of time. But having listened to an interview from the developer, Andrew Scholdice, this game was very much inspired by his childhood memories of playing video games and specifically not being able to read the manuals to said video games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of... you talked about a little bit of Dark Souls influence, but I remember with Dark Souls, like, part of the game's feel was like, this guy couldn't read this English encyclopedia growing up, this Japanese guy who designed it. And he was like trying to recapture that, like, you get bits and pieces in the item lore and you got to piece things together, kind of like how he couldn't understand everything. I kind of got this game did the same thing with like a game manual that you can't understand.
Absolutely. I feel the same way. And I think the interesting thing is that that feeling of genuine sort of mystery and discovery was definitely one of those things that came through in every part of this game through, I guess, the entire thing. So many different portions of it made me such sort of scratch my head initially and think, what the heck? And then it's recontextualized later and you're sort of revisiting all of these various areas and then there's a new mystery to uncover. It's very much one of those peeling back the layers of the onion games. I think that makes Fez an apt comparison for sure. Interestingly enough, this game was originally called Secret Legend when it was debuted at the PAXes of the world back in 2015 timeframe, to which I have to say, well done ditching that name.
Yeah, I actually was looking at the soundtrack earlier and I paused when I saw that song title and like, wow, that is a that's the title right there.
I mean, they're kind of like very on the nose with that title, right? It's a game about secrets and it mimics Legend of Zelda. So sure, Secret Legend. It's a good it's a good prototype name. But Tunic is definitely, yeah, it's a much better, I guess, namespace to be occupying.
I agree. And I actually think it harkens back to Zelda even better then, because the tunic of the game's title is referring to, of course, the green tunic that our fox hero is wearing, which, of course, he has a green tunic, he has a sword and shield, so obviously gamers of a certain cohort, which I guess is a euphemism for saying old-ass gamers like us now. you know, we will be like, oh yeah, we've played Zelda, unlike all these other people who, you know, kids these days wear Zelda, wears or Link wears blue going around everywhere.
Yeah, fair enough. We are old school tunic heads. But no, I hear you on that. And I think this is definitely a thing that struck me when I was playing this game, is how many callbacks to, you know, The Legend of Zelda, the whole style was definitely coming through to me. But maybe let's set up the game. You know, how's it open? You already mentioned we're a fox. We're a fox, and we wake up on a beach wearing a green tunic. Everything about this sounds very similar to a certain Link's Awakening to me, except for the whole fox thing.
True. So you get up on the beach and you start wandering around. You fight some enemies. You find a stick eventually. You come across signs written in a foreign language, completely like incomprehensible.
Gibberish.
Yeah, gibberish might as well be, but there is occasional English, like you see Hero's Grave and an arrow pointing off this way or that way, and you kind of explore around and you're starting to piece things together, especially when you find that first page of the manual.
Yeah, and this is kind of where the game to me like starts to get its own very specific flavor, because the manual looks completely different from everything else in the game you've seen so far, which by the way is beautiful. Maybe let's camp out on that and then go to the manual, because when you're waking up on this beach, it's a beautiful isometric view, sort of flat color but extremely well lit, low poly beach. You know what it looks like to me is like Monument Valley has a heavy influence here, if you recall the iOS game, on my particular iOS Mount Rushmore. Mm-hmm. Monument Valley.
Yeah, isometric view is more of a classic choice for 2D games and sprite-based games, and I think this is really why the Death's Door and Tunic comparisons happened so frequently, because both games were kind of action adventure games, but both were released in a 3D isometric viewpoint, which isn't true 3D in terms of like perspective or whatnot. It's an isometric game does not have perspective on it. You're looking at everything straight on. Things don't get closer as you get closer to them. So it's kind of like a trick of a camera. It's a bit of an it's definitely a look, though, but it harkens back to like earlier games because of this. Like, if this game was like a 3D, like a Short Hike style, you know, still charming low poly visuals, it doesn't have the same look to it.
Yeah. You know what I think helps it is the depth of field in this game. You have sort of the blurring of the background to show that there's like far away depth to the scene rather than just what's there on the page. And that isometric perspective lends itself to like lots of blind corners where some of this game's signature moments come from, namely the secrets, hidden exits, entrances, and all of the above.
Oh, yeah, and I think this game, I know Death's Door did a little bit of this as well, but I feel this game was just, like, lousy with doors here and there. Every time I saw a bush or a corner or a tree, I shoved my fox into there right away to see if he comes out anywhere else, because all sorts of secret passageways and doors and everything like that.
Yeah, I think the developer has a quote saying, like, why was it a fox? I think the reason that a fox was chosen is because they couldn't come up with a acceptable, customizable human model that they could let players be. So they went with an anthropomorphic fox, which was appropriate because foxes get into trouble. And in this game, you're definitely getting into trouble. When you go into some of these secrets, like you said, Josh, I feel like initially, like, some of them are just cool little extras. You get an item, you get an extra upgrade material, you get some treasure. But sometimes you get something that just makes you look at it and think, like, there's more going on here than I thought. There's, like, some weird underlying, I guess, story or lore implications to what is going on in this world that I'm just not privy to quite yet. And I felt that many times in this game.
Do you remember any specific instances?
So I'm thinking about like areas where you start to see like some more machine-like aspects to like below ground areas where there's that like neon colored light goo flowing from areas. And you're starting to like understand that there's like an underworld where there's something underpinning all of the like more parochial and bucolic overworld where you're seeing like windmills and lakes and cottages and stuff like that. You know what I mean?
Oh, agreed. I think what you're referring to specifically, there's a kind of like this electrical power that, you know, you go up to these obelisks, these monoliths, and you can activate them to send this electrical power elsewhere, power up your shrines for save points. You power up, you know, doors to get through them and everything. And then you go to the atoll. I forget what the adjective before the atoll is, but the beach level. And one of these power lines you've been playing around with the whole time is busted open. And there's this black goo flowing out of it. And you get up to it a little closer. And it's not only damaging, it is like ultra damaging. It doesn't lower your health, it lowers your max health. So the longer you stay next to it, the shorter, the less and less damage you can take. So you realize that like the stuff that is powering the world is probably not great.
Radioactive, perhaps. Mm-hmm. Yeah, or something deeply unsettling. It is the gloom from Tears of the Kingdom, to pull a reference forward to 2023. At any rate, I think that's kind of the main thing is like these secrets are kind of getting you to think like, now what exactly is going on here? And there's so many of them in this game. We'll talk about some of the more intricate ones as we talk about like the post-game story or secret stuff. But I think what I like about how secret heavy this game is, as you said, it shot through with them, is that there's so much generosity in the secrets on display here, and so much of it most people won't see. Like, I think once again, to continue with the developer quotes, is they said there's a percentage that they see people on certain secrets, and so they put more and more provocative stuff behind the lower percentages of secrets. So like, oh, this is one only 10% of people will see. Well, let's put something real weird behind there that's gonna reward the real freaks that are finding the only 10% secret. And there's, I think another thing that I think I've said this before is that I really love when studios put in secrets that not many people are going to see, or entire areas or models or, you know, art or something that most folks just won't see. It is incredibly disincentivized by big studios because you're putting work into something that isn't going to, you know, pay off in terms of your company's stock price or whatever. And I love when a game being a piece of art is just throwing that out the window and saying, I'm going to make some shit that most people won't see. I love that.
It is nice, especially for a game as dedicated to secrets, making them worth the payoff, whether that's mechanically or narratively, is definitely a good thing to have. You know, you don't want to like find the secret passage and be like, and you picked up 2 gold.
Exactly.
You found a quarter.
Make it count. Make it like,
oh, that's what I hated about Arceus, if you remember that from our podcast. Like, I'd go down these long winding roads and they're like, okay, here's a tree. Like, come on. Exactly. Come on, guys.
You get 2 tree nuts for that. And maybe, I mean, sometimes they would reward you in that game with like a unique Pokemon, but it would only appear at a certain type of day under a full moon. And like, if you show up during a Tuesday and it's a half moon, you're just shit out of luck. But you know, I don't know, that again, that goes back in the face of, I like when things are subversive like that, but I also, I don't know, you need to balance your accessibility with your subversiveness, I think is what I'm getting at here.
I think one thing this game does very well is advertising that there's a there. Like, there's a lot of secrets, and you can go ahead and go nuts about this game because we have this whole constructed language going on here. So you know that we're serious about these secrets here.
Yeah, so that brings us back to the instruction booklet, which I steered us away from, and now I wanna steer us back to, because, man, this thing to me is like the signature part of this game.
Oh, totally agree. This was an amazing mechanic they had because, I don't know, it goes back to that nostalgia factor, too. I mean, when's the last time you read a game manual?
I mean, last time I bought a physical game with a good game manual, I don't know, Morrowind? it's right? been a minute. Yeah.
It's both like a thing games, like a time you made the game, and also I think a time of the life as well. Like, I remember reading the Heroes of Might and Magic 3 manual cover to cover over and over again, because when you're 12 you have unlimited free time compared to what we have now.
Well, yeah, and you're like comparing the stats on the units between the different factions because you're like, all right, which one of these is for me?
You're almost like playing the game in your head.
Yes, exactly. And that's kind of like part of the magic there. I mean, I think everyone in our cohort has this memory of, you know, driving home from the video store with the box, you open it up, you pop open the manual, and you're reading it, just thinking about everything that waits for you when you eventually get in. You pop that cartridge or CD into your game system, and you get to experience the world that is being described to you on the page here. And that, like, sort of priming the pump for everything that is to come is just a memory that isn't really being experienced as much as I understand it in this day and age.
Yeah, I think, like, you'll still see these gorgeous art books and things in collector's editions, but as far as, like, just regular gorgeous manuals go, those are more a thing of the past. They actually served a specific function back when, too, as a primitive form of DRM to prevent people from pirating the software. Like, I don't know if you remember King's Quest VI.
Oh, yeah.
With the cliff puzzle where you have to translate the language where there's, like, no clue what you're supposed to do.
And that explains why I never got very far in that game.
Huh. The translation was in the manual. So if you didn't have the manual, if you just pirated the copy, or, like us, just had a digital copy without the manual later on, then you can't progress in the game unless you randomly hit buttons and hope you get the right word.
I think by that point, I had considered myself a pro gamer and decided I didn't need to read instruction manuals. Well, that's what I get. That's what I get for that one. Either that, or I got it from the library. And usually, instruction manuals didn't make it through the first several lendings from a library, if you know how that goes. At any rate, the manual in this game also has evidence of previous lenders, if you will. There's notes in margins and scribbles, and It offers some basic hints just on the page, but there's also hints from our mysterious author.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, hints about what you're supposed to do next. Like, I like this manual a lot as a manual. And I think one of the pieces of merchandise you can order from this game is a physical copy of that manual.
You're kidding. I kind of want that now. because what we haven't mentioned yet is it's beautiful. This is incredibly well illustrated and gorgeous. It's a wonderful manual.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think this manual served a very specific purpose in the game, too, of you get like one page of the manual, and it's like the first page you get is, I think, like page 13 and 14, front and back. So right away you're like, oh, I got part of a whole thing right here. There's more out there. Let's read over this. What does it tell me how to do? It tells you some basic, like, it tells you some basic things to do in the game, or like some basic controls. But then it also has a reveal, like if you hold down the A button after you dash or after you roll, you can start running around. And as soon as I saw that, I'm like, holy shit, this manual is how I unlock abilities here. Yeah. It's not like you gained the hookshot or anything. It's you read about the hookshot, and you had the power in you all along, but the game is not letting you know about it until it's time.
I do love that. Like the fact that the game has within you the ability to kneel and pray, and if you do that at a save point, you unlock, quote-unquote, the ability to level up. And that holy shit that you just said a moment ago, you'll have that moment multiple times in this game if you're, you know, playing it unspoiled, as hopefully everyone in this cast did and then decided to listen to us. but yeah, I really love that feeling. And this game like tried as hard as it could to like make you remember what that feels like and manufacture as many opportunities as possible for you to feel it again. And I really loved it for that.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Part of the way that they encourage that discovery is the game's manual, like the game itself, has a limited amount of English in it. I think more in the manual than generally in the rest of the game. But it's enough to give you specific pointers and tips and make sure you know what you need to know, but at the same time suggest that there's other stuff out there. Now, I've only looked at this a little bit, but it's not a simple cipher where it's like a substitution cipher. This symbol means A, this symbol means B. But I guess there is a whole like new grammar and writing system behind it. So they did go deep for the language nerds out there.
Yeah, it's like a phonetic language, right? Like it translates phonetically rather than straight cipher A to B or A to M, et cetera.
You looked into it more than I have. nerd.
Yeah, I didn't do much. This was beyond me, to be honest. But no, I tried to read a bit about it. Apparently, there's a second hidden language that is sound based in this game, which is hidden within some of the key sounds and the music and hidden in spectrographs and things like that. So there's layers and layers and layers here. It's kind of almost as deep as you want it to go. And here we are sitting, you know, in 2024, and I'm pretty sure all the secrets have not yet been discovered for this one. Who knows if they ever will be.
Oh, that's great. It's good to if you're the certain type of person who likes that puzzle, then this is a good game to sink your teeth into.
Absolutely. And Godspeed if you are someone who's going to try and do that yourself. I am not that type of gamer. I like that this game gives you multiple off ramps, and I took the first one.
Well, that's another function that the manual had, because it's throwing all this gobbledygook at you. But also, you find another couple of pages, and you get the map of the main area, the overworld area, which also has some instructions for you, like ring the east bell, do these steps, ring the west bell, do these steps. And kind of has like pictographs like you need to pick up the shield from here, you need to pick up the lantern from here, which is a good way of giving you objectives without, you know, giving you an English quest like go to the old well and dive in.
Yeah, it's really elegant, because you're absolutely right. Like this is how like the original Legend of Zelda, or perhaps Zelda 2 Adventure of Link, structured how you should know what the fuck you need to do. Because otherwise you kind of don't. that's a well-observed point that the quest sometimes isn't necessarily as present in the game as one might hope, or it's present, but it's in another language that you can't read, or maybe you can't read because you're five. but either way, the fact that you can kind of figure it out from the pictures in this game and do that, you know, two bells, then three keys, and then ... is it's a fun way to progress the game. And I think at that point, the game kind of squarely goes off the rails into, like, there's way more going on here than you originally thought territory.
Yeah, and even in the main kind of story on this, but maybe, you know, before you get to the story, you certainly get to the combat of the game first. Whether you're first coming at them with a stick, which you do until you get the hero's sword, and then after you get the sword and the shield and various magical items as well to upgrade your arsenal, I thought the combat was good in this game. Like you said, you thought Death's Door was better. Curious what your thoughts are there.
Yeah, so I personally felt that Death's Door's combat was better because it just felt a little tighter. This kind of, to me, is like maybe a comparison between just like a faster, tighter battle system and a more intentional, strategic one, because I understand the appeal of Tunic's battle system with like the needing to manage the stamina. I think it's worth mentioning just on the face of a lot of this game is that the Souls-like flavor and influences are several, varied, and sometimes a little ill-advised, in my opinion. like they have the Estus, you know, your potions that return upon resting. They have the stamina and the iframes on the roll.
Oh, I have a question. Did you get the potions? I didn't get the potions till I was in the West Garden.
Oh, yeah, no, I did. I don't remember exactly when I got them because I played this much longer ago than you did. But
oh, I'm sorry. No. Not when you obtained them, but when you realized what they did.
Oh, I can't recall. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay, fair enough. Game was easier when I realized I had health potions.
Yeah, I can imagine. This is one of those games where the game was easier when I realized X applies to many, many things. Like, I realized I could level up my attack or defense or stamina. And, to my mind, like, I just found the game or the combat in this game a little less parsable, a little less even, and perhaps not quite as complex or nuanced as the difficulty of it supported. Like, it was way harder than it was complicated, you know? Like, I feel like in a game that gives you extremely hard combat, like your Dark Souls of the world, you're given a lot of different ways to approach a different situation or a given situation and a lot of nuance with how you can prepare for it. And I don't necessarily think that level of resolution is present in Tunic, so I think the combat is going to be one of the things that I think slightly bristle at of all of the offerings in this game.
Huh, interesting. I enjoyed the combat. Like, it definitely had a flow state to it. One interesting thing I think between this and Death's Door was Death's Door was kind of more like tight combat in a room designed. Like, you go into a room and now you gotta fight three waves of enemies in this small tactical space where the designer is able to know exactly where you are, where you can hide, and what you can do. And Tunic's in the more kind of like the overworld tradition where it's like you come across enemies on the map and you dispatch them from a distance or more almost always getting up close. And it's kind of like a little bit looser because of that too. Like, it's harder to design when the player can just run away when things are getting bad.
Except you can't really run away because there's no tether on any of these enemies. Like, they will follow you to the ends of the earth.
Oh, if you get back to a statue and you pray there or you fall asleep, then all the bad things go away. It's great.
Yeah, but yet another one of my complaints of the game is going to come in here. I think those prayer areas, the checkpoints, are a little too few and far between for my taste. And, you know, I'm starting to sound a little negative on this game, and I'm just remembering now why, like, you know, I didn't get quite as far as you in it. But, you know, overall, it's still a very positive experience for me, but there are definite things that, like, kept it from being, like, top tier in terms of, like, the raw mechanics and offering on display. And I think so far, we've hit on two of them, the combat and perhaps the checkpointing.
Oh, you know, thinking of the combat a little bit, and because this game did come out at the same time as Death's Door, I think what... I think I like the combat in this better than Death's Door, maybe for the same reasons you don't like it. But also, I do remember I like the bosses in this game better. Like, the boss battles were more fun for me than in Death's Door. And that might be negatively weighting down Death's Door for its damn final boss fight, which I found infuriating.
Yeah, I think if I were to come at this game now, I would absolutely have just turned on no-fail mode. But that's fine. I'm glad that's in there, and I should have used it at the time. Maybe it wasn't. I think they patched that in at some point. It might not have actually been there when I played the game. At any rate, I'm with you that the bosses in this game are great. I have very fond memories of like the knight and the siege engine enemy, and even like the asshole at the bottom of the mines. But to your point, like, I think some of the later bosses started to get a little too hard, and I think that's actually where I tapped out.
This game, after you ghost out and you go into the cathedral, the one time I didn't like its boss battle was they had a time where you fight two of the garden knights at the same time. And I don't know, if you're Dark Souls and you're just trying to kick the player in the nuts, then sure, you can get away with that once or twice, but I felt like this game didn't earn the lazy double boss battle move.
I mean, the double boss battle is always a kick in the nuts. Like, I still think the hardest fight in Elden Ring is the fucking two gargoyle fight underground. But yeah, I don't know. Like, I hear you on that. Like, and there's a time and a place for like extremely hard boss battles, and like, I don't know. Dark Souls 1 is the only one that I've seen like successfully deliver like an Ornstein and Smough style fight and it actually be good. I don't think I've seen it repeated, unfortunately.
Is that the Bell Tower double gargoyle fight you're thinking of?
That's a good one, but the great one is the one that happens when you get to Anna Orlando and you're up in the cathedral and you have the fat guy and the lancer side by side.
Oh, I never got that far.
Yeah, I figured not, but that's the one I'm talking about for the listener.
Fair enough. the listener who is better at that game than me.
I'm not going to say that's a tall ask.
It sure isn't. No, but good boss battles in this game. You go through the first couple of them, and you ring those first two bells, the East and the West Bell, and that opens up the first golden door, which takes you inside this temple where you find this big fox spirit imprisoned by three keys. So you're on the quest to get three keys now.
Mm-hmm. Yep. You get your keys, you find one at the top of a cathedral, and you fight the librarian. Probably one of my favorite fights in the game, actually.
Oh, librarian, excellent great
boss.
Fight.
Yeah. Probably the best boss.
Actually, I like the theme of the boss. I felt he was an easier boss, but I might have been cheesing him somehow.
Fair enough. The forest vault, you find a red key, the siege engine, also a great fight. Yeah, great bosses in this game, you're right. And then the bottom of the world through the quarry into that weird factory with the pink death juice. Obviously, like, so much great, like, imagery down there.
Oh, yeah. So those obelisks, those electrical obelisks that I mentioned before, you go down to the quarry where they're breaking down all these electrical apparatus, and you go into this factory where you find out these obelisks are being created by imprisoning the souls of other foxes. And it's like they're being crucified and seemingly in pain and as they go in there. So
you're telling me crucifixion's painful?
I mean, they probably said something about it in that constructed language, so I'm just guessing right here.
Sure, of course.
But you get the third key after you go through this factory where you're like, oh, you know, all this power in the world is being generated off of like evil means and whatnot, which is always a cool reveal.
Yeah. There's more going on here than meets the eye situation is coming back. So yeah, you finally get all the keys, you put them in the door, and nothing happens.
Is that, I got, no, you go to the fight. Don't you?
Yeah. So nothing happens at the door. What you have to do is you go to that warp area and you see that the elder fox lady is released and she gets a sword and knifes you.
She just shanks you right away. Yeah, that was a fun little moment. And I thought what was great about this too, like right after you get shanked, because you come back as a ghost and you lose all of your upgrades that you've worked so hard for over the game and you have low health again, which
this is where I almost quit the game.
Yeah, I thought about it too at that point. But very soon after, as it goes to find, I think it's the next page you find, or very soon after, where the manual just doesn't have maps and like illustrations of the controllers. It also has like artwork of key scenes. Like, you get artwork about the librarian before that battle. You get like an artwork and an introduction to the scavengers before you go into the quarry and the factory and everything to learn about what they do. And there's half of this bifold illustration you have the whole game, where you have your fox with his sword and shield, and he's facing off against something, but you never find out what until you get shanked. You pick up the next page and it's like, oh, it's the fox lady I thought I'd been trying to rescue this whole time.
Honestly, such a great reveal. Like, what a wonderful way to use that manual page mechanic to, like, show you the enemy that you thought was your friend. And, like, it does slightly undercut the idea that this is a manual that you're getting with the game in full.
Oh, because absolutely.
Why would you free the thing that you know is going to be your enemy? I don't know. It's... either way, it works in the moment.
One of the things that works in the moment, too, is that the left side of that bifold, the side you start off with, says, like, the title of it is A Battle Fought Since Time Immemorial, or something like that. So you're like, oh, this must be the bad guy. This is like a Link versus Ganon thing, and it's just been fought over and over and over again. So then when you get shanked by the air, by the ghost, and you find out, you find that other page, you're like, oh, not only have I just got shanked, I've been shanked a whole bunch of times before. Like, this ain't the first rodeo here. It adds like that layer of story to it very simply, with just a phrase. I love it.
Yeah, I love that too. And it harkens back to, as you said, your Links and Ganons and your perhaps your light the fires of your Dark Souls and things of that nature. There's lots of sort of cycles and breaking the cycles. You know what it actually reminds me of too is Hollow Knight. There's mm-hmm. a cycle in play there as well.
Have you looked into the endings for this game very much?
Mm-hmm, I have.
Okay, I gotcha. Because that comes in play later on too.
Yeah, we'll talk about it. To your point, I love the sort of nuance and, once again, recontextualizing everything that's happened so far in the game that even this one simple addition of a page of the manual can do.
Living as a ghost is not so good because you still got to fight things, but now you're back down to your starting stats in terms of health, attack, defense, potion, heat effectiveness, all that stuff.
Well, hey, at least you have your spells and stuff.
You do have your spells.
Yeah, you can use your fire magic and your ice dagger.
You go back to the overworld where you see that, you know, most of the enemies are gone and there's a bunch of ghost foxes just hanging out, leaving you a little bit of clues, talking about things. You go through the swamp and the cathedral. You do the bullshit final boss or double boss at the bottom. And then you get the dash ability. The dash ability lets you skip over small gaps in the platforms, which they've been bugging me since the game started. I'm like, there must be a jump ability somewhere or something.
Oh, yeah. You knew this game is pretty clear with its highlighting of mechanics you will soon get to overcome obstacles.
But there were still a lot of secret places where you would use that dash mechanic, including in the teleporter room, which you glaze over the first time because it's not obvious you're supposed to go over and dash over that way. But what you use the dash ability to do is to restore all of your upgrades and powers. So you do eventually become corporeal again and not a ghost, which is great because having health and attack power is fun.
It is kind of a long and drawn out process, though, is it not? Like, it feels to me like this particular ghost restoration process, like, just it was a bit of a hike, honestly.
Yeah, no, I agree. Like, I didn't think it was... They did some interesting things because they made you do combat as a weakling, which after you've been powered up is an infuriating move, but one I ultimately appreciated. And then in the cathedral, they introduced a new type of enemy that had a special type of sword that instead of taking temporary damage, it was like the black goo. It lowered your max HP as well. So I felt like that upped the stakes combat-wise in a way they hadn't before. Before it was just like, we're introducing this black goo. Don't go near it when you're in combat, because that's bad. And now it ups the stakes again. So I appreciated the game for that. The cathedral might have been a little too long, that part of the level. But maybe it was worse for you than for me.
I think it was. This is probably just a point at which I started getting impatient, and that's on me. But at any rate, there's always going to be places where pacing either works or doesn't work, or perhaps just isn't as good. But either way, it made the payoff worth it, because at the end of the day, as you said, there's still a lot left to discover even after restoring your fox to his corporeal body.
Oh, yeah. And one of the things you get, there's a couple of pages you get, I think, around the time you finish that cathedral bit, talking about choosing your path. And it's clearly referring to the end over here. You can fight the air, which is the big boss battle now that you're back in fighting fox form. Or the other one is share your knowledge. So the easy thing you can do right away is fight the air. And if you defeat the air, then it goes down this whole Hollow Knight path.
Yep. Yeah, that's what I did. This was the first off ramp, and I took it.
Oh, okay. So you did do this. I didn't go through this ending.
Yeah. So, no, as soon as I was able to, I went back and I got my revenge and recognized that this was the bad ending. and then I thought, well, what do I need to do to get the good ending? And, well, I'll let you explain that part, because that's where I noped out.
So the bad ending in particular is you defeat the air and then you become the air. And then the obvious implication is this, but that you're going to shank someone sooner or later, and that the battle is going to be fought again and again and again. So that's the continue the cycle one. The break the cycle ending involves what they call the Golden Path, which starts off with the Holy Cross, a.k.a. the D-pad.
I love this reveal. I think that's so clever. Basically they keep referencing this Holy Cross, and you get references to it in your manual pretty early on. And you're like, when am I going to get this Holy Cross? when can I finally use the Holy Cross? And you finally realize it's been there the whole time. It's your D-pad. And so you get to put in these Konami codes to utilize it, which is so cool.
So this one actually worked a little less for me. I decided early on that the Holy Cross was the fireball wand. And every time I saw the Holy Cross, I'm just like, oh, fireballs. And I actually, they do this thing where they have these other golden doors in the world. Like the original one you opened up using the ringing the bells. But these ones you open up using the D-pad, inputting a sequence of directions on the D-pad, and then the doors open. So I realized how to open the doors using the D-pad, because they gave clues to that in the manual. But I still didn't make the connection Holy Cross equals D-pad until the end of the game, or until I read about it online.
Yeah. I do think this was one of the more extreme logical leaps they could ask the player to make. But, kudos to you if you actually made it. But boy, it is it's a cool reveal. And I really like that they just sort of let you input random directions and have that be a key to a door. The idea being that if you came into the game with this knowledge, you could have opened these doors at any time. What a neat idea.
It's not just hitting random buttons at randoms, but the doors have their code embedded in the door. It's like engraved inside of them. You start, like the witness, you start from the circle and you go up the path turns left, so you turn left until you finish putting the code in.
It is very witnessy.
That's not the only place they put the codes in, though. You will start finding this pattern. You will find it embroidered in a tapestry. You will find it in the tiles of a floor later on. And if you put in the codes at these places, you can unlock treasure, particularly these little fairy spirits.
Yeah, and these fairy spirits are part of what you need to do to get the true ending, as I understand, yes?
The true ending is the Golden Path, which means you find every single instruction booklet page. You complete the page, which they have two particular endgame puzzles for the first and last pages of the instruction book. The last page is done by finding 10 of the 20 fairies, and this was the one I almost didn't finish because I thought, oh, this is going to be too hard. But actually, doing it in the overworld map, I was stumbling across fairy puzzles once I knew what to look for fairly easily. And they also have a little spell you can cast that if you're nearby a spot to find a ferry, it lights the way towards that for you, which is a little bit nice. The other puzzle that I learned what I was supposed to do and noped out on it immediately was the mountain door puzzle, which is impressive, but also not for me. What you do with the mountain door puzzle is they have a 5x5 grid on like page 53 or so, I don't know, late in the book where you find it. And each of these squares is a page number that you go to, and you have to figure out a set of directions.
A grid of the pages, right?
Yeah, it's a grid of the pages, and each of the pages will have like some hidden information on it that if you put all those pages together, it forms a door code nearly 100 commands long. Actually, I think it is 100 commands long.
Yeah, I remember reading about this.
So you have to like figure it out, and like some of those pages, again, once I knew what to look for, I could find it, but other ones, even when I looked online where it was, I'm like, no, that can't be it. But surprise, it was that. So I feel like that would have been a puzzle I would have really enjoyed when I was 14 and had free time.
Yeah.
But as a less free time person now, I was not sad to say that I'm happy to go to the internet and have them tell me what to do.
Yes, for the time constrained. We are thankful for the internet and the super sleuths out there that actually put the time in to do this. thank you, super sleuths.
Yes. So you get the you go through the mountain door. You get the first page of the manual, which is kind of like a thank you from the devs, like a small handwritten note from them. But once you have the completed manual, instead of fighting the air, you can be like, hey, check out this cool book. And then you're buddy. You go through ending credits while you're like chilling on some waterfalls and dancing around a campfire, things like that.
Yeah, you share the knowledge of like of the cycle, I suppose, and all of the harm that it could cause in the future, and then everyone decides that's not such a great idea, and that's nice. If only it worked like that in real life. At any rate, I think it's admirable that they put this second ending in, despite the fact that it's relatively inaccessible for, let's say, 99% of the people that will play this game. Unless, of course, you decide to take advantage of, as we mentioned, the aforementioned super sleuth effort that has already gone into making this a bit more accessible for the everyday person.
Yeah, yeah. I think there could be fun being part of that initial effort when the game first comes out, like figuring out what everything means. But at the same time, too, that's a time limited gameplay right there. Like, we can't go back and do that, be part of that community again.
Yeah, we would have to specifically find and form a community of people that have never played Tunic and yet are extremely into puzzle games, which is probably non-existent at this point.
Very possibly.
At any rate, it's a cool idea. I'm glad that this game decided to put so many deep and intricate things into its offering. And to that end, I mentioned earlier that there's also an audio aspect to how intricate this game's secrets can become. Some of that is in an auditory format, but I guess even on a surface level, this game's audio offerings are sublime. I mean, this is a soundtrack by Lifeformed, which is a extremely well-regarded sort of synth and electronic musician. It's an album that like perfectly underscores the mystery adventure, and it's like 60 tracks long and 3 hours long. Like, there is a ton of extremely good music in this game.
Now, I will say this is a genre of music I normally don't care for much myself, but I did get really into this game's soundtrack. Like, there were just some beautiful pieces out there.
Yeah, I mean, I remember like sharing a track in the Discord that we were talking in and like saying, oh, this kind of sounds like a Chrono Trigger track. And then there's others where it's like much more mysterious. And, you know, it reminded me a lot of the soundtrack in Fez by Disaster Piece. But like, it definitely took on its own thing as well. You know, Lifeformed and Janice Kwan combined on this one and created just a ton of incredible music for it. You know, you will have heard a bunch of it throughout the course of this podcast, and if you're a fan of this style of music, it makes the absolute perfect music to work to. I have listened to it sans game many times at this point.
Well, with that, let's move on to some three-word reviews. My three-word review for Tunic is Lost and Found. Tunic is a game that wears its inspiration on its sleeve. It's a wonderful homage to early Zelda games and, in a way, the magic of childhood and discovery. Harkening back to an era of gorgeous physical manuals containing vital information, the game places a fictitious manual inside the game to be reassembled piece by piece in what is easily my favorite part of the game. Finding a new page, particularly early on, revealed a little more of the game world and its workings. You would unlock new abilities, not explicitly, but by reading about how to perform them. It reminded me of some of my earliest experiences playing video games, and perhaps I found a feeling that I thought lost long ago.
Agreed. Nice to have found it again. Mm-hmm. My three-word review is Game About Gaming. Tunic is a game about what it's like playing games, or at least what a certain person of a certain age thinks it's like playing games. In short, it's about the sense of wonder and discovery that video games are uniquely capable of providing. Uncovering cheat codes, validating playground rumors, mastering combat mechanics, and of course, understanding a story that isn't quite what it seems. Tunic practically begs the player to ask questions from the jump, and it almost always rewards them with a satisfactory answer. If I really think about what many of my favorite games have in common, it's rewarding players for their curiosity. And this has been true for a long time. The 90s era manual, the clear Legend of Zelda inspiration, the Konami code-like D-pad puzzle, and even the sometimes ill-advised Souls-like mechanics. Everything in Tunic is so fundamentally, cohesively saying one thing. This is a video game, and this is why you love them. Regardless of how much of Tunic one ends up seeing, it tailors itself to what gaming is to you. And with that, I'd like to say, thanks for listening. And if you enjoyed this podcast, then feel free to share it with folks you think might enjoy it as well. And if you'd like to get in touch, drop us a note at pixelatedplaygrounds@gmail.com or contact us on Twitter/X @PixelPlayPod. And for us here at Pixelated Playgrounds, I'm Brian Skirsha.
I'm Josh Galecki.
Take care and keep on exploring.
No, one thing that this game really reminded me of was a puzzle box. Like, you pull this lever over here, and then you can open this drawer, and when the drawer's open, then this thing over here. It's like, each discovery leads to more discoveries over there, especially between the manual and what you'd find in the world. Like, it just felt very generous with its secrets, like you said earlier.
Have you ever played the Room games?
I don't think so, no.
So these are like, once I mentioned the iOS Mount Rushmore above with regards to Monument Valley, I think the Room series of games is also on that Mount Rushmore for me. If you ever get your hands on an iOS device, iPad, what have you, download the Room 2, and probably the Room 3. All of them are wonderful puzzle box games, and they do exactly what you're talking about here, and all of them can be beaten in the span of probably under 3 hours apiece, generally.
Okay. Oh, that sounds good. That sounds good.
But yeah, puzzle boxes are so fun. And like, to your point, this is an excellent iteration of it. Like, not quite understanding how things relate to each other, but yet it all sort of, like, not making sense. Because I think this game explicitly tells you, like, in real life, this makes no sense. But in this video game, it makes sense.
I don't know. There was a kind of a feeling I think they cultivated successfully, especially early on in this game, between the way the world was laid out, between you coming across a constructed language and coming across a page of the manual where you're like, I'm only getting a piece of the information over here. But it felt like I wasn't sure where the game was going to go in a way that I fundamentally, like, when I start Elden Ring, I know where the game is going to go. I don't know where I'm going to go or how I'm going to get there, but I know what the game's going to have me do. And I feel like the earliest Zelda, the first Zelda, kind of had that same effect on people because it birthed a whole genre. When you birth a genre, nobody has done that thing before.
You fundamentally don't know what it's going to end up at.
Yeah, so I think this game did a very good job of recreating that feeling. I've actually never played the first Zelda. We should do that this next year.
Lots of opportunity to. Yeah, it's on Switch.
But yeah, I feel like this is a very good recreation of that feeling if you were going to be a kid in, you know, like 1989 or whenever the first one came out.
Hang on a second. Move your head.
Oh, yeah.
That's a tunic guy. You
I'm
have a tunic
out.
Guy.
I'm merged out.
You've got a tunic guy on your shelf behind you.
I like this game enough that this is my first video game merch down here.
I mean, it's a cute fox, and that's an adorable little piece of video game merch you have there, Josh. I guess now we know where Josh stands on tunic.
Giving
He's
them
got
more
the merch.
Money.